London Column. This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headlined or modest, but all selected for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. Today we look in on the oddest breakfast yet served at London's most exclusive hotel. We raise a salute to the 100-year-old bowler hat, or derby if you prefer, and we join the mourners at the graveyard of London's doomed streetcars. And we'd better get the sad business over first.
Clang, 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 went the trolley. Ding, 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 went the bell. Ding, 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 went my heart.
For the moment I saw her, I fell.
Since the beginning of the century, London's buses have been fighting and beating London streetcars. And for the many hundreds of streetcars that have rocked and rumbled through the suburbs of London, across the Thames bridges, and along the tree-lined embankments between Westminster and Blackfriars, for these red juggernauts, the end is at last in sight. They're to be replaced by $25 million worth of buses, modern and manoeuvrable. The death throes of the streetcars began this last weekend, when the better part of 100 trams, as we call them, towering double-deckers, made a last sad journey out of town to a specially prepared graveyard, a crematorium. A crematorium, if you like, because after the reusable portions, such as motors, are salvaged, the remainder is for the flames. Well, motorists whose cars have skidded on the rails or whose tyres have been slashed by them long ago consigned the streetcars to the flames. But now, at last, the wish is coming true, car by car. And we send our reporter, René Cutforth, to watch the funeral pyre.
At the moment, men are at work on the doomed tram with sledgehammers and oxyacetylene apparatus, dismantling the mechanical parts, the tram pole and the windows, and the part at each end with the brass handle sticking out of it. And while they're busy with this, an electrically driven platform called a traverser is bringing another tram parallel to it. And now a tractor pushes this other tram the last few yards until it's dead opposite the one that's going to be burnt this morning. Now they're hitching a cable onto the dismantled tram. It goes right over the top of it. It's fixed somewhere at the bottom on the far side, and it goes right over the top, and the men pass the cable on through a pulley wheel, which is anchored to the base of the second tram. And they hitch the cable end to the back of the tractor. Now, we're ready to go. So we're ready to go, and someone rings the bell for the last time, and the tractor moves forward. The rope tightens. The tram swaying, the tractor wheels are skidding round. It reverses for another pull, and it charges forward. She's swaying. She's over. The tram fell over in a great cloud of black dust, and now men are stripping wood from the cables of rubber-covered wire inside the tram, and a man with an oxyacetylene lamp plays it for a moment on the rubber. A tongue of flame licks out over the woodwork. The fire spreads. It spreads very quickly indeed. In a very short time, this tram is a roaring furnace. It's on fire all over.
And from now on, a continuous bonfire of London streetcars. For them, it really is at last the end of the line.
And it was stand just to stand with his hand holding mine to the end of the line.
But something else is cooking in this program, and much more fragrantly. Kippers. Not the canned kippered herrings in tomato sauce that you may know well enough, but Scotch kippers, fresh from the smoking. About 100 newspaper men have just made a special breakfast of them at London's Carriages at Till. There was a reason, of course. We want you to get to know and like this favourite British breakfast dish. And this was a send-off of 4 million kippers due to go to the States every year. From Carriages at Till, too. Rather as if you had staged a clam bake in the ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria. Well, here at London's slap-up kipper breakfast was our reporter Douglas Willis.
The proceedings opened with a short speech by Sir Frederick Bell, chairman of the Herring Industry Board, who said that only the best summer kippers would be sent to America, as the winter kippers live on their own fat and become thin and scraggy. The summer kippers, he said, are fat and juicy. They've been wrapped in transparent tissue, they've been deep frozen, and they were on their way, 4 million of them, in refrigerated ships at this very moment. An American journalist asked Sir Frederick Bell how he recommended kippers should be cooked. Sir Frederick, after some hesitation, because he said there were several different ways, gave us this recipe, which is entirely his own, and I gather he accepted no responsibility. Put the kippers, he said, into a casserole with a little butter on top, and pop them in the oven for a quarter of an hour. Then, he said, there's no smell in the house. A lady journalist sitting nearby added that margarine would do just as well as butter. Afterwards, I asked an American journalist if he thought the kippers would go down well in America, and he said that he thought that they would for a time, but we would have to suggest 5 or 6 different methods of cooking and serving them. He suggested that they might be covered with tomato sauce or with mushrooms, or that they might be served as an hors d'oeuvre. That's what he said. I'm reporting it, not advocating it.
Down in the meadow in a little bitty pool swam 3 little fishes and a mama fishy too.
Swim, said the mama fishy, swim if you can. And they swam all over the dam.
The humble kipper is Scotch in origin, but essentially English is that hard felt hat with rigid brim and dome like the Capitol at Washington, the bowler. Bowler, did I say? The derby, you know, Dave. A versatile hat and much more worn here than in America, the bowler, with the rolled umbrella and pinstripe suit, the mark of the British businessman. With tweeds and shooting stick, the correct thing over here for the point-to-point steeplechase spectator. And since it's part of the woman's horse-riding outfit, too, we'll let a woman tell you about the bowler's centenary celebrations. Sheila Stewart.
In the famous old shop that sold the first derby, it's called a Cook or Coke hat, because it was a Mr. Cook, spelt Coke, who came into the shop in 1850 and explained that when he went hunting, his top hat kept getting caught in the branches of trees, and he wanted a lower hat, lower and sort of rounded at the top. So his hatter said, "Certainly, sir," and they in turn applied to a firm of hat makers called Bowler. And Mr. William Bowler actually made this revolutionary hat. I've been down to the little shop, just by St. James's Palace, and I've seen the original entry in the old ledger. The Honourable Henry Coke, 1 Coke hat, 12 shillings. And that's only about $1.75. The crux of the centenary celebrations was a cocktail party, at which the centerpiece was an enormous iced cake, shaped like a bowler hat, and bowler hat cocktails were served. There I had the pleasure of meeting 3 generations of the bowler family. Mr. Thomas William Bowler, aged 85, the second generation since the advent of the hat they created, his son and his grandson. There was one entertaining episode. By way of showing the permanent popularity of the bowler with the smart young man about town, they'd invited 4 officers of the Guards Regiment to be present in their traditional civilian walking out dress. You see, if you're in the Brigade of Guards, you have a civilian uniform, as it were, too. It's a must in London to wear a dark suit, a red carnation in your buttonhole, a guard's tie, an umbrella, and a bowler hat. Well, when these 4 were called, they stepped forward as one man, bowler hats in hand. But when it was explained to them that they were expected to put their bowlers on, well, I mean to say, guards' officers don't wear their hats indoors, and in the presence of ladies, too. So after a whispered conversation, one tight-lipped young thing of about 20 said, "If you don't mind, no." The speech of the evening was made by the famous author and broadcaster James Laver, who made this point, that man's domination in the home has always been influenced by the height of his hat. In the days of the top hat, he was really the master. With the bowler, he was already thinking a bit. In the early 1900s, when woman's emancipation was on the rise, man's squashing was evidenced by the Homburg, and his complete submission now was proved by his tendency to go about without a hat at all. And he urged all men to get together and buy hats, and the higher the better. Well, in case there's any truth in that, let me say quickly, I think you men look wonderful with your hair blowing in the breeze.
Where did you get that hat, and where did you get that tile? Isn't it a knobby one, and just the proper style? I should like to have one, just the same as that. Wherever I go, they shout hello. Where did you get that hat? Whoa!
And if there can be a postscript to streetcars, kippers, and derby hats, well, London columnist Alan Melville, who never wears a hat at all, not even to talk through, is the one to produce it. Alan?
This is Alan Melville speaking. Not a few tears are being shed and not a few letters written to the papers over the demise of London's trams. For, they were as much a part of the London scene as the flower sellers in Piccadilly or the fountains in Trafalgar Square. As integral a part, you would have thought, as is the kipper on a hotel breakfast menu or the bowler on a city stockbroker's head. They weren't like your streetcars. They were double-deckers and therefore of considerable size. And most of them were loosely constructed so that when they got up speed, they clanged, rattled, shivered, shook, and clattered in a most alarming fashion. They also cultivated, when driven at speed, a strange, rhythmic, undulating motion, dipping up and down like the Queen Elizabeth forging her way through a heavy Atlantic swell. And unless you were a good sailor, you were really safer in a bus or a taxi. Many's the time when the driver was behind his schedule, when the upper deck passengers have been observed clinging to their seats for grim life and turning faintly green around the gills. They were run, of course, by overhead cables from which fierce sparks shot out at intervals to add to the terrors of transit. There's an underground subway in London into which the trams plunge, are hidden for a time from the public gaze, and then suddenly re-emerge at a very busy traffic junction. They re-emerge up a fairly steep gradient, and they've got to pull out all their stops to make it, and to a stranger unused to streetcars, the sudden appearance of these monsters, rocking, snorting, swaying, clattering, and sparking like things possessed, never failed to terrify. The London trams were, I suppose, a menace to other forms of transport. I know my own car is fascinated by a set of tram lines and is drawn relentlessly towards the grooves, especially in wet weather, either remaining in the grooves for miles or skidding across the street in an attempt to get away from their Svengali-like spell. And it would seem that if you have trams, you must also have cobblestones, a fiendish form of road surface if ever there was one, particularly in Belgium, where I suspect the automobile manufacturers subsidize the authorities to lay down ever harder and more irregular cobbles so that automobiles fall apart within a matter of months. And yet, well, one is sorry to see the trams go finally off their rails. They carried a great many passengers very cheaply, and there was at least this to be said for them. You knew where they were going. They couldn't, as all other brands of road transport can and do, single out a pedestrian and make a sudden swerve off their beaten track to get him before he reached the safety of the sidewalk. There was, if you recall the famous limerick, a young man who said, "Damn, at last I've found out what I am, a creature that moves in determinate grooves, in fact, not a bus, but a tram." But alas, while the human creatures who move in determinate grooves increase and multiply, their clattering mechanical counterparts, in London at any rate, are doomed to extinction. Goodbye.
Thank you, Alan. And it's goodbye, too, from this edition of London Column, a Radio Digest produced by Stephen Eckard, presented by Peter Watson, and which came to you in the North American service of the BBC. That was London Column, a transcribed program. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.